down to verse 14, for when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another, in the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ according to my gospel. And then notice again the shift, verse 17, behold, thou art called a Jew. Restest in the law, makest thy boast of God, knowest his will, approvest the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law, and art confident that thou thyself art a guide of the blind, a light of them which are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, which has the form of knowledge and of the truth in the law. Then you have five questions from Paul designed to prick the conscience of the Jew. Verse number 25, for circumcision verily profiteth if thou keep the law. But if thou be a breaker of the law, thy circumcision is made uncircumcision. Therefore, if the uncircumcision keep the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted for circumcision. Down to chapter 3 and verse number 1, the beginning of four questions that Paul asks. He says, what advantage then has the Jew? What profit is there of circumcision? Paul gives the answer, much every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. Down to verse number 9, he's now concluding his section. He says, what then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise, for we have before both proved both Jew and Gentiles that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Verse 18, there is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world become guilty before God. Therefore by the deeds of the law there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. That's where our section ends, but just notice the shift again as he moves into a new section. If you're in the habit of highlighting or underlining your Bible, these are two words that are fundamental to the epistle, fundamental to history. Verse 21, But now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith in Jesus Christ unto all and upon all them that believe, for there is no difference, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And we do trust the Lord will bless this lengthy and in some parts complicated portion of the Word of God. Before we come to this section, I think there's four things that we just need to have in the back of our minds as we come to it. Four things that will just be helpful in setting the context, I think. First of all, the significance of this section, the significant place that Paul begins as he's going through the A to Z of the gospel. As I look around, there's a few people who weren't here with us last week, so just for the sake of connection, we noticed in verse number 14, these three I am statements of Paul, what they've been called the forgotten I am statements of the New Testament. Verse 14, he says, I am debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians. So first of all, Paul thought himself as a debtor to the people who needed the gospel. This was his responsibility to preach. Then we notice verse 15, he says, so as much as in me is, I am ready. We've got his responsibility to preach, but his readiness to preach. He thought of the gospel as a debt that he owed men and women, that they needed the gospel, but he also recognized his readiness to preach. The word for ready really is the word eager. So this is his eagerness to preach. Every opportunity he had, he longed to preach the gospel. Then in verse 16, after we've had his responsibility to preach, he says, I am ready to preach. And now we have his reason to preach. He says, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Now the reason that I'm mentioning is this is because he gives us four reasons why he was not ashamed of the gospel. Four reasons why he loved the gospel, why if he got to Rome, he wanted to preach it. So first of all, notice this. He says, for or because it is the power of God unto salvation. Number one, Paul loved the gospel, and so should we, because it's the power of God. It's the power of God unto salvation. We noticed last week it's the word dynamite. It's the dynamite of God to save men and women from their sins. And then he changes and he says, for it is the power of God. It's linked with the power of God. But verse number 17, because therein is the righteousness of God revealed. So it's his reason to preach. First of all, it's the power of God. And second of all, it revealed the righteousness of God. And then thirdly, notice verse 17, because it is written, the just shall live by faith. So three reasons now. We've got the power of God, the righteousness of God, the word of God, and then verse 18, the fourth reason Paul loved to preach the gospel, because of the wrath of God, because it answered the wrath of God. The gospel answered the wrath of God and his wrath against sin. So four reasons: the power of God, the righteousness of God, the word of God, and the wrath of God. Now I say all of that for this reason, because this is a significant section in the epistle. As he's dealt with the introduction, verse 1 to 17, he now moves into the A to Z of the gospel, and the starting point that he has is with God. Because the gospel begins with God. The gospel really is, the whole of the epistle is an explanation of the gospel of God. And so he begins the gospel with God, because the gospel must begin with him. And it begins with the wrath of God and with the righteousness of God. And the righteousness of God, the holy response of God to sin, is the wrath of God. And it's revealed against, number one, all ungodliness, and second of all unrighteousness. So ungodliness is this idea of God not being estimated in the right place in people's minds, in the minds of men. It's ungodliness. He's not where he should be. They were denying his person, abandoning his person. And then from that stems unrighteousness. If God is not where he should be in the minds of men, from that stems the conduct that reflects that, and it's unrighteousness. So you have ungodliness, unrighteousness, and you see that in the Ten Commandments. The first commandments were to do with God, the Godward aspect, that which was to put mankind in the right position about what God was to men and women, and then you see the conduct that stems from that in unrighteousness. And so his wrath of God is revealed against all unrighteousness and all ungodliness of men. Now this expression, this idea of the wrath of God, is something that can sometimes be misleading and can be misunderstood. This is not the idea of God. In fact, I don't want to make anyone offend for a word, we're all learning as we go along, but there was one person who I remember saying, this wrath of God is like God flying off the handle in relation to sin. That cannot be the case. This is the settled, abiding attitude of God against sin. This is his anger against sin, but it's a settled, abiding, consistent attitude through history against sin. So the picture of Romans is, of course, this courtroom drama, God in the God presiding over the situation as the judge. And just like in our own courts, the role of the judge is not to emotionally respond to the case. Whatever atrocities are brought before him, whatever the depths of sin has been brought before him, he's to act in accordance with the law to make sure that justice is carried out, but not to emotionally respond. If you're in a right courtroom, you'll not have the judge flying off the handle or emotionally responding. It's the fact of a presiding judge. So we have here the wrath of God, as God is presiding in dignity over a case, and he's dealing with sin. This is his wrath. Now, I could ask the question, what is the opposite of the wrath of God? Paul doesn't begin here, as he's speaking about the gospel, he doesn't begin with you or I. He doesn't begin with what God wants to do for us or in us. It begins with God and begins with his wrath. And the opposite of his wrath, you might say, well, why doesn't he begin with the love of God? It's famously said that the love of God doesn't come in until Romans 5. The gospel doesn't begin with his love, it begins with his wrath. But the opposite of the wrath of God is not the love of God. The opposite of the wrath of God is his indifference to sin. It's his indifference. In fact, the wrath of God and the love of God, they don't contradict. They go side by side. So that if there was a terrible case of maybe a child being abused, the wrath of God is against the abuser because he loves the child. So that the wrath of God is an evidence of the love of God. So you have, the gospel then begins, the significance of this section begins with the wrath of God and the righteousness of God. Now it's also significant that he begins at this point with the condemnation of mankind, not only because it's to do with the wrath of God, but because it's to do with the righteousness of God. It vindicates God's righteous dealings with mankind. You remember that at the start of time, in the garden with Adam and Eve, you remember that the devil goes to Eve and he plants in her the doubt that God isn't as consistent, his character is to be questioned, his dealings are to be questioned. And ever since then, mankind and the devil have been questioning the character of God and his dealings with mankind and his righteousness. And this whole section vindicates God in his attitude toward mankind. No one can ever come up against God and say that he is not just in the way that he deals with men. Because at the end of this section, it's going to say every man is without excuse, and it's going to say every mouth is stopped. That's the function of this whole section, is to prove that man is thoroughly guilty. No one can, at the end of time, have an excuse and say, well, I didn't know this, or I never understood your ways, and so on. This is all to prove the thorough guilt of mankind. And also, just finally on this point, it begins with this section, because that's where, I suppose, our gospel preaching ought to begin as well. It begins with sin. No man can understand his need for Christ until he understands condemnation. And so it's a significant starting point in the epistle. And I was just recently been going through Acts and enjoying the fact that as Peter is preaching and Paul is preaching, they don't hold back on preaching sin. They don't hold back on this section. And that you remember Peter stands up and he speaks about those who had crucified the Lord of glory. He speaks about those who were taken with wicked hands and slain the Son of God. And he doesn't hold back on the guilt of mankind. And I should just say this, that this isn't the feeling of guilt. As Paul begins the Roman epistle, he's not trying to get men to feel guilty. This is the fact of guilt, or if you like, forensic guilt. This isn't so that men might just understand their sinfulness and feel guilty before God. It doesn't matter whether they feel guilty. The fact is the fact of their guilt. So it's a significant position that he begins the epistle, the significance of the epistle, of the section, sorry. But then think about the standpoint of the section. Verse number 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. So we're going right back now to the Old Testament. We're going right back to the beginning of time. Now, some people suggest that this is exclusively the flood, but I'm not too sure. But either way, it's the wrath of God is revealed, and the tense is continual. So it's the wrath of God continually revealed from heaven against all ungodliness. It's continually revealed, so you can think of the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve were cast out, as an expression of the wrath of God. You can think of the flood. You can think of the wrath of God being expressed against Sodom and Gomorrah and so on. And so we're at the beginning of time. But then move over to chapter 3 and verse 21. I tried to highlight it as rereading. He speaks about this time statement. He says, but now. So here is a moment in history, but now. And if you want that backing up, verse 26, he says, I say at this time. So we're beginning at the beginning of history. This is what this section is dealing with. Chapter 1 of verse 18 is the beginning of the Old Testament. And then in verse 21 of chapter 3, it's the cross. So 4,000 years of human history is being summed up here. I think it's 1988 or something like that, Stephen Hawking released a book called A Brief History of Time. And it was a bestseller, I think 25 million copies sold and so on. And people were fascinated with this man's view on time. Well, I like to think of this section as God's brief history of time. This is 4,000 years of history summed up by God from the beginning of the Old Testament right up to the cross, and his declaration over it all is every mouth stopped, all the world become guilty before God. This is his brief history of time. Now, you might ask the question, the fundamental question, why did Christ die in 33 AD and not so soon after the flood, after the fall? You remember that Eve, when she had Cain, she said, I've gotten a man from the Lord. She thought when her first son was born, she thought this was the promised seed and that the Redeemer had come. And little did she know that it would take 4,000 years of human history before Christ would come to the cross. And you might ask the question, why 4,000 years of history? Why did God leave it so long? And among many reasons, one of them is this, that there was 4,000 years needed to prove the thorough guilt of mankind. 4,000 years to show that whatever setting man was in, whatever country they were in, whatever privileges they had, whatever preachers were sent to them, whatever prophets they had, they were thoroughly guilty and in need of a savior. So 4,000 years of history, the significance of the section, but also the standpoint of the section. But there's also a sweetness to this section. This isn't a passage that's often turned to in conferences or even in ministry meetings, and you might just wonder, is there any encouragement to be gotten from a passage like this? It seems to be a very dark picture here is being painted. There's not much to encourage the saints in it. But then against a dark background like this, chapters 1 to 3, what it actually does, as Paul is painting a very dark background, is it magnifies the grace of God as it comes in later. Against this dark background, the section afterwards from 3 verse 21 just shines brighter. Now, I've never had to go to a jewelry store, and maybe I will someday, but they bring the jewelry to you, I imagine, not in a white box or in the hand. They'll put the ring or the gem on a black cushion. And the reason they do that, of course, is so that against the black background, against the black cushion, the jewel just shines brighter. Well, the jewel of Romans 5 and of the rest of the epistle, it just shines brighter against this whole background of chapters 1 to 3. And so where sin abounded, you remember Paul speaks about grace did much more abound. And so what he's doing is he's painting a dark background against which the grace of God can shine brighter. But then finally, the structure of this section. The structure. This is where we've got the handout. This will likely be the last one that we have in this series, so don't worry. This is just, I think just with large sections like this and with complicated language, it can just get easy to get lost sometimes. So this is the broad structure of this section. Paul is going to leave no stone unturned. His purpose here is to prove the universal guilt of mankind. And so what he's going to do is he's going to take mankind right back to Genesis 9, when the three sons of Noah are sent out to populate the world. And what he's going to do is, in order to prove universal guilt, he goes right back to the three sons of Noah. And you'll know that all of us are born from at least one of them. And so that's how he's going to prove universal guilt. And he moves from verse 18 of chapter 1 to verse 32 to the end. He's going to speak about the sons of Ham. Really, it's the idea of rebellious man. This is the pagan nations, the idolaters, wanted nothing to do with God. They exchanged everything God had revealed to them for their own desires and so on. This is the sons of Ham. And all of these other titles are just put there so you can pick one that you most affiliate to. And then you have, in chapter 2, verse 1 to 16, not now rebellious man, but this is respectable man. This is the man who looks down on the sinner of chapter 1. He reads all of these sins, verse 29, 30, and 31, all of these abominations committed by the idolaters, and he says there has to be some sort of moral standard. And he looks down on these others, and within himself he knows there's a standard. He knows there's some kind of moral code, and he condemns those, but he practices privately what he condemns publicly. And so you have respectable man, this is the respectable sinner. Then in chapter 2, verse 17 to 3, verse 8, God deals with the Jew. He's dealt with the Gentile, with the idolater. Now he's going to deal with the Jew, and he says, just as equally as guilty, the Gentile's guilty on a different basis, but now the Jew is guilty, and he speaks about religious man and the sons of Shem. And within these three people, you have the three kinds of sinner, the three kind of person that you might speak to. Maybe one of us can relate to one of these people in our past, which kind of sinner we were, whether we were rebellious, I don't care for God, there is no God, I'm an atheist, I want nothing to do with him, there's no moral code, we do as we want and we die. That's the first man, the rebellious man. But then you have respectable man. This is the man who says, I'm a respectable person, I don't do these things that other people do, you know, I keep some kind of standard, but he still doesn't bow the knee to God and trust his son. This is respectable man, but then you might come across another person in the street who says, I go to church, I do the best I can, I keep the rituals, I do all of these things, but he's still condemned. And so you have the three kinds of sinner in this section. And then finally, at the bottom there, from 3 verse 9 to 20, you have the sentence, the verdict of God, and he just puts them all together and he says, all the world guilty before God. You have all of these inclusive statements, all the world guilty, all under sin, every mouth stopped. And then you have all of the expressions at the bottom, none that righteous, and so on. And so, like a courtroom drama, all is guilty, the verdict's been given. And then as I've written here about these witnesses, just like in any courtroom, you have witnesses brought up so that the witness from around condemns rebellious man. This is creation. Witness from within is the conscience, and witness from above, the covenant, condemns the Jew. And increased revelation. With increased revelation comes increased responsibility. You can see the increase here. You've got creation, which is generic, but everyone can see it. It's general revelation. Then you have much more specific revelation in conscience. And then you have special, or if you like, scriptural revelation in covenant. And you can see how with increased responsibility comes increased revelation, and yet all the world is guilty before God. So that's the general structure of the section. And we should say as well, this is dealing with Old Testament. But as the wise man in Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. And so all of these things can be seen today, of course, as the wrath of God is being revealed in his removal of restraints. And so on, all of these sins are still with us. So although it's talking about Old Testament, of course, it can still be applied afterwards. And after we've had creation, conscience, and covenant in the New Testament, you have the gospel writings, and God doesn't reveal himself in creation, nor conscience, nor covenant especially, but he reveals himself in Christ. And man has been given the ultimate privilege of seeing God incarnate, his standard incarnate, the glory of God on earth in a man, and yet they still rejected him. And so you can see how thoroughly guilty mankind is, no matter what witness they have, no matter what privileges they are given. Now, we cannot go through this section in enormous amounts of detail. We'll just have to sort of take a helicopter view and look at some of the highlights as we're going through. So think about this rebellious man, rebellious sinner. God has clearly revealed himself in creation. You remember Psalm 19 speaks about the heavens declaring the glory of God. Every man can see creation and see that there is a creator. Abraham Lincoln famously said, "I can see how it might be possible to look down upon the earth and be an atheist, but I cannot conceive how he could look up into heaven and say there is no God." True that statement is. He speaks about the fact that there is creation. Every one of us can see it. God has put himself on full display to man, just even looking at the creation around us. But before that, just notice verse number 19. He says, "Because that which may be known of God," before he even speaks about creation, he says, "because that which may be known of God is manifest in them." So first of all, man knows within himself that there is a God. I can't remember the name of the philosopher, but someone went to him, he'd written many, many books, and someone went to him and said, "What's the biggest evidence for God? Try to convince me now that there is a God." And he says, I don't need to do that, he says, "because you know inside of you that there is a God." And so each one of us, however we might have suppressed it, that's the idea of verse number 18 when it speaks about those who hold the truth, those who suppress the truth, hold it down. We might have suppressed it, but each one of us knows that there is a God. And that is one of the biggest, I think, encouragements for any gospel preacher, to know that whoever they're speaking to, no matter how atheist they are, deep down within them, they know there is a God. And so you have there the fact that it's been manifest in them, but then you move to verse the end of 19, and it says, "For God has showed it unto them." Now, it's speaking here really about the stars and so on in heaven and the trees that can be observed. But even today, man can see far more of creation than these people could in the Old Testament. We can now see the right down to the atomic level. We've got microscopes that can see right down into the very smallest of details, and we've actually seen more of creation now. And so we should be far more convinced of a God, and yet man still suppresses that and distances himself from God. Now just notice very quickly these three things that God reveals to man in creation, or three things that he's revealed to the idolater. Of course, to every man, but specifically here to the idolater. He speaks of all, first of all, in verse 21 and verse 23, he's revealed the glory of God. This is speaking about the glory of God. This is the revelation of God in the glory of God. Then in verse 25, he speaks about the truth of God. And then in verse number 28, he speaks about the knowledge of God. So God is revealed in his grace, in his mercy, on full display. In creation, he's revealed the glory of God, the truth or the reality of God, and the order of God. But then you notice what, and I tried to highlight it as we were reading, notice what man has done with that revelation. This is man's response. To the glory of God, they exchanged it. I mentioned that because no man can change the glory of God. You understand that? So it's the idea of exchanging the glory of God for an image. They took what God had revealed to them in the glory of his person, the glory due to his name, and they exchanged that for their own idols and for images made like to corruptible man, to birds and beasts and so on. And you can see through history how man has worshipped creatures and things like that. And so they've exchanged the glory of God for their own idolatry. Then they've exchanged the truth of God, or the fact that there is a God, they've exchanged it for a lie. Then they've exchanged the order of God in creation, and they've exchanged it for their own pursuits. That's verse 28 down to verse 31. They've exchanged it for their own desires, their own pursuits, their own lusts. And in all of that, just to get the big picture of what's going on, they're exchanging what God has given. This is why I've called them rebellious man, because they're exchanging everything God has revealed to them. They're just changing it and exchanging it for what they want. And really, this is the root of sin. This is the very, when it's boiled down to it, sin is not a white lie. It's not just something casual rebellion. It's not a swear word here and there. It's complete rebellion against God. It's the exchanging of what God has revealed, and it's the pursuit of own desires. And then notice, after we've had the revelation of God, the response of man, but think about the retribution of God. You've got the glory of God, the truth of God, the order of God, and God, in verse 24, you have God gave them up. Verse 26, you have God gave them up. Verse 28, God gave them over. Or it's the same expression, God gave them up. Now, the idea here is not that God has abandoned mankind. It's not that he's allowed them to do this sin. The idea that he's given them up is that he's removed restraints. He's seen where mankind is going in his rebellion, and he's removed restraints as an expression of his wrath towards sin. He's removed the restraints and just allowed men to go where they were already going. So that no man can say to God, we were only in our sin, we were only going this way in rebellion because you removed restraints. The idea is that they were already going this way, and so he gave them up. Now notice how he gives them up. Notice the restraints that he removes. God gave them up, verse 24, to uncleanness. He gives them up physically. Then verse 26, God gave them up to vile affections. So he's given them up physically and he's given them up emotionally. And then in verse 28, God gave them up to a reprobate mind. So he's given them up mentally. So what God failed, what mankind failed to give to God, emotionally, physically, mentally, all of these things that God was robbed of is how he gives them up. He gives them up to uncleanness, to vile affection, to a reprobate mind. And what man has failed to give God, he's given them up. Now, sometimes when we think about the fall, we're thinking about what mankind lost. We're thinking about the fact that we lost a relationship with God and all of these other things that we think about. And yet sometimes we neglect what actually God lost. God lost far more than we did at the fall. He lost a mankind, a race of men and women who would give him glory and ascribe to him glory. And so this glory of God that they denied, exchanged for their idolatry, is what God lost at the fall. And so in verse 31 and verse 32, you have the concluding statements that they not only did the same, committing these sins, but they actually have pleasure in them that do them. I read some time ago, Bill Clinton, after the scandal that he was involved in, there was one survey that was taken, and his approval ratings as president actually went up after the sin was revealed that he was involved in. And this is Romans chapter 1, verse 32, the fact that men take pleasure in them that do the sins. This is how reprobate man has become. And so you have, they are condemned based on creation. God has revealed himself to them, they've abandoned him, and so on. We can't stay longer with that. But we'll move on to verse chapter 2 and verse 1 to 16, the respectable man. So rebellious man has been condemned based on creation. Now we have respectable man. These are people, as I've said, who've looked down on the sinner of chapter 1. They've looked down on his sins. They have a sense of morality, but they condemn others and they forget that God is actually condemning them as well. So their judgment is based on their own standards and not on God's. Now, just three things here. We could say more, but we'll just keep it to these. So there's three things here that they fail to understand. They firstly fail to understand that within them is the capability to commit any sin. They're condemned on that basis because within them they can commit any sin. Within any of us is the ability to go into any kind of sin. Second of all, they didn't realize that to break one commandment is to be guilty of breaking them all. With us, we can break the law if we're caught speeding or something like that. We're breaking one aspect of the law. But with God's law, if we're breaking one aspect, we're guilty of breaking the whole thing. We're all below God's standard. His standard is perfection, and so to break one law is to break them all. And they fail to understand also that sinful thoughts are sinful, are equal to sinful actions. And we're thinking of Matthew 5 and the teaching of Christ in the Sermon on the Mount, that to think something is equal to actually doing it. And they look down on others. And what this man needs from Paul is a sermon on the judgment of God. And that's why the judgment of God comes in here in a full force. So as Paul is writing to the Romans, he speaks about these people, and he speaks about chapter 2 and verse 3. He speaks about the judgment of God being inescapable. No matter what you try and do, no matter how, if you blame it on your neighbor or if you look to other people, it's still personal and it's inescapable. He mentions the fact in chapter 2, verse 6, that it's actually individual. He quotes Psalm 62 and he says, "Who will render to every man according to his deeds?" So it's not only inescapable, but verse 6, it's individual. So don't compare yourself to your neighbor. You one day will face God, is the point that he's making. And then verse 11, he speaks about the judgment of God being impartial. God is no respecter of persons, and it's impartial judgment, and God judges based on people's own individual acts. And then he says, in the concluding statement of chapter 3, all are become guilty, and all are below the standard of God. Now you say, do they have any excuse? Can anyone lift up their voice in accusation or in defense? Can they have a defense lawyer in their courtroom? Well, we've noticed creation condemns the first man, but now conscience condemns this man. He might not have the Hebrew law and access to the Hebrew law, but what he does have is the heart law, the law of God written in his own heart. This is verse 14 and 15 and 16. They show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another. So within them is the law of God. They understand that actually when they are committing sin, they feel guilt about it. They feel and they know instinctively they're doing wrong. And so in acting against that conscience, they are thoroughly guilty. But then to verse 17. So you have rebellious man, respectable man. But here you have a religious man. And he's speaking to the Jew. This is the major section. Some people don't see three sections. They maybe just see the first section being the heathen and the section and this section being the Hebrew. But in verse 17, he says, behold, thou art called a Jew. And what he gives is he gives a whole list of things that the Jew boasted in. In chapter 9, I think it is, you get a far more greater list of the privileges of the Jew. But what he gives here is all of these things is what the Jew boasted in. So first of all, he says, behold, thou art called a Jew and restest in the law. So first of all, they boasted in their unique race. Behold, thou art called a Jew. Back to the origins of this word Jew and this title being given went all the way back to Abraham in Genesis. And so they boasted in the history, in all of the gravitas of this word Jew, what it meant to be a Jew. So they boasted in their unique race, but then they boasted in their unique refuge. He says, you're resting in the law. And they boasted in God, their unique relationship. They thought they had exclusive rights to Jehovah. They misunderstood and they'd got far away from the truth that when God had chosen Israel, when God had given them so much privilege, it was only so that through them other nations could be blessed. They'd lost sight of that and they made it their boast that they had exclusive rights to God. And so they made their relationship a boast. Then they made the revelation a boast. In verse 18, they thought they knew his will and they were being instructed out of the law. So they had a unique race, unique refuge, a unique relationship that they were boasting in, their revelation they were boasting in, their responsibility they were boasting in. Verse number 20, yet they thought themselves instructors of the foolish and teachers of the babes. They boasted in their responsibility to teach other nations and to reveal God to the other nations. Israel was an evangelistic nation. They should have displayed God to the other nations. And instead, verse 24, the name of God was being blasphemed among the Gentiles. Now, if we just stop for one moment, just to get a practical point here, other nations saw the Jew and they were meant to see God. They were meant to see Jehovah in these people. In their marriages, in their conduct, they were meant to reflect God. And yet, because they didn't do that, the name of God was blasphemed among the other nations. People looked at the Jews and thought, we don't want your Jehovah if this is how you act. And just a very practical point that I say to myself, can people look at us and say, and do they see a reflection of who God is? Do they see God in his people? Or is the name of God blasphemed among the people of Northampton because of us? Just a practical point on there. So they boasted in all of these unique things. This is the calling of the Jew. But then you have verse 21 to verse 24, you have the conduct of the Jew. Their privilege and their privilege didn't match up with their practice. Their calling didn't match up with their conduct. So that in verse 21 down to verse 24, he gives them five questions to convict them of what they were doing. He says, you who teach others, do you not teach yourself? You who preach a man shall not steal, do you yourselves steal? They were being hypocrites. He says, you who say a man should not commit adultery, do you yourselves commit adultery? He says, you who abhor idols, do you not yourselves rob temples? And his final question is, you who boast in the law, do you not dishonor God by actually breaking that law? And so he's exposing them to be hypocrites. But then you have the circumcision of the Jew from verse 25 to verse 29. It's really the idea of the fact that they were boasting in this this outward act when actually internally it was not consistent. They were showing themselves to be separated physically, And you remember what happened in Israel and Gilgal and so on. When they first crossed into the land, they were to be separated from the nations. That was to be shown physically through circumcision, and yet their practice, their inward conduct, was absolutely inconsistent with what they were outwardly. And so they might as well just have been uncircumcision, is the point that he's making. They might as well just have acted like the Gentiles. And then in the first seven verses of chapter 3, you have the condemnation of the Jew. Chapter 3, verse 1, what advantage then has the Jew? What profit is there in this, in being a Jew? And he says there's many things. Verse 2, many things, many privileges, because, and then perhaps one of the chief reasons, unto you was committed the oracles of God. You had the very law of God, you had the very purposes of God given to you, revealed to you, and then all of these other questions flow out from that, and they were condemned based on covenant. They'd been given absolute every privilege possible, they'd been given the grace of God, they'd been given the law of God, all of these things, and yet they failed and were guilty before God. And really the whole point is proving that no matter what God privileges man with, he is utterly guilty and condemned before God. Now, we move out from those three sections and move to verse number 9. Apologies, we're going at breakneck speed here. Verse 9 to verse number 20 is the sentence, the very verdict of mankind, the verdict of God against mankind. Now, one of the common questions, I think, that people seem to have is, well, God can't condemn me now. In my lifetime, I still have time to prove that I'm worthy and so on. And when I get to the throne of God, when I get to Judgment Day, I'll be able to state my case and things will be weighed up and it will be in my favor and so on. And yet this whole section proves that this is the verdict of mankind, the verdict of God against mankind, and it was given 2,000 years ago. In another place in the New Testament, it speaks about us being condemned already. So this is the great verdict of God. It's already been given. No man needs to wait till a future day. It's already been given. Every man is guilty before him. And he gives verse 10 down to verse 18, as he does right through the epistle, he brings in the Old Testament. And he says, this isn't something new that I'm preaching, the condemnation of all mankind. He says, this isn't something new. And he proves that from the Psalms and from Isaiah. And he shows that actually the Old Testament also showed the utter guilt of mankind. And so he quotes many Psalms and a section from Isaiah. And he gives these four none statements. Now, just while we're on this point, I remember Ian Paisley. I don't remember Ian Paisley, but he used to publish in the papers the title of his Sunday sermon. And one of the Sundays that he was preaching, it was published in the paper that on this particular Sunday, Ian Paisley would be preaching on four black Roman nuns. And these were the four black Roman nuns that he was going to speak on. None righteous, verse 10. None that understandeth, verse 11. None that seeketh after God, verse 11. And then none that doeth good, verse 12. The thorough guilt of mankind. There is no one found worthy, no one able to give a response to God. And then you have in verse 19, now we know that whatsoever the law saith, whatsoever the Old Testament says, it says to them who are under the law. Now here we have a problem that has confused commentators and Bible teachers through centuries. Here's the problem. He says, it says to them who are under the law. So here you have the Jew. Whatsoever the Old Testament says, it says who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world become guilty before God. So all who are under the law, so the Hebrew, he's condemned the Jew, but then somehow he moves on and he says every mouth is now stopped and all the world become guilty before God. So there's a whole chasm here. How does he get from, Paul get from someone who is under the law to then condemning the whole world? Now the gap, I suppose, can be reconciled in this way. What he's speaking about is the fact that the Jew was condemned as a sample nation. God had given Israel every privilege possible, and yet they failed. And because they had failed, as a sample of the human race, God is now able to say, because the sample failed, the whole of the world is corrupt. So if I were to go to a doctor's appointment to get blood taken from my arm, if they tested that sample of blood and it was some corruption was found, it's not my arm that's condemned, it's the whole of my body. Because a sample's been taken, the whole thing is condemned. I think William MacDonald gives a similar illustration. He speaks about if you lower a bucket of water into a well and take the water, test the water, it's not the bucket that's condemned, it's the whole of the well. And so here he takes the Jewish nation as a sample. They've been given the privileges, they've been given all of these things, and now based on that, because of their failure, go right through the Old Testament to see how they failed repeatedly, and because they failed, all the world is now guilty before God. So then you have this concluding statement, In verse 23, all have sinned, all have come short of the glory of God. Mankind is on the precipice of eternal judgment. There's no hope for mankind. There is no helper for mankind. And they're all guilty. Now, I just want to get us, before the end of the meeting, I don't want to leave us at that point, although that is the end of our section. I do want to just get our foot in the door for where we are going next week. And I want to prove that although in verse 23 he says, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, there is another all. All have sinned, and then verse 22, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith in Jesus Christ, unto all. He's condemned the sons of Ham, the sons of Shem, and the sons of Japheth, but when the gospel starts going out in the book of Acts, it's going to go to every single person as well. I want to just prove that practically and to wake us up a little bit. So Acts chapter 8, first of all, we'll just try to prove this point. Acts chapter 8, he's condemned in Romans 1, the sons of Ham, sons of Japheth, sons of Shem. From Acts 1 to 7, the gospel has been in Jerusalem. The gospel has been spreading to the Jew, and in a watershed moment in the book of Acts, it now begins to go out to the uttermost parts of the world. So Acts 1 to 7 is Jerusalem, and then you move into Acts 8, and it's now going to go to the world. So notice verse number 26 of Acts 8. The angel of the Lord spake unto Philip, saying, arise and go towards the south, unto the way that goeth down from Jerusalem, unto Gaza, which is desert. And he arose and went, and behold, a man of Ethiopia, an eunuch of great authority under Candace, queen of the Ethiopians. And you know the story well of how this man was eventually saved. This man is a son of Ham, a barbarian from Ethiopia. He's a classic example of the idolater of the first section, the rebellious man. And now the gospel begins to go out, and the first person to be saved, in this chapter at least, is this Ethiopian. So the Ethiopian, the rebellious man who's been condemned in Romans 1, is now reached and saved. Now go over to chapter 10. Chapter 10 and verse number 19. Philip's gone out and he's gone to reach the son of Ham. Now we're going to see Peter go out. So verse 19, while Peter thought in the vision, the Spirit said unto him, behold, three men seek thee. Notice the expression again, arise, therefore, and get thee down and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them. And then he goes down, verse 22, to a man called Cornelius the centurion. So the gospel's gone out in Acts 8 and it's reached the son of Ham. Now it goes out and it reaches the son of Japheth, reaches this Gentile Cornelius. And then in chapter 9 and verse number 11, the Lord said unto him, that's Ananias, and this expression comes up again, arise. Arise, go into the street which is called Straight, and inquire in the house of Judas for one called Saul of Tarsus. So each of the sons of Noah have been condemned, and now as the gospel goes out, he's going to reach a son of Ham, son of Japheth, and now he reaches a Jew. He's reached a barbarian, he's reached a Gentile, now he's going to reach a Jew called Saul. And so the same God who condemns every sinner, all three types of sinner, is the same God who, when the gospel starts going out to the uttermost parts of the world, is the same God who reaches every kind of sinner as well. So the gospel goes out to each and every person. And it's all on the basis of faith in Christ. We'll leave it there. Draw the line. In verse 21, we'll think about but now next week, and we'll really be focusing, we'll be slowing right down and looking at a paragraph. Verse 21, I think, down to verse 26, slowing right down and looking at that section, showing how God can be just and the justifier of him that believeth in Jesus, how he can righteously save men and women on the basis of faith and on the work of Christ. And we will think about that next week. We thought about man's ruin this week, and we'll think about God's remedy and man's responsibility next week. So we trust the Lord will bless these things to us. Apologies for just rushing through that, but we trust something will have just encouraged us or helped us as we've gone through this epistle. Shall we just pray?